Ladier, with those exceptions, the numbers were used rather than names?
Yep, in this case, all the juror questionnaires were distributed to defense counsel, prosecution.
That is correct.
And the jurors were informed that, that was the case, right?
That's correct.
Okay, let me ask you a question that's bothering me, that I asked before and Mr. Carberry didn't answer. The two-pronged federal test, Mr. Michaels takes the position, and he may be right, that each one of these cases involves, or the two-pronged test is triggered by some failure to disclose.
That is incorrect.
Okay, tell us about that.
The two-pronged test is triggered when any form of anonymity is going to be considered and then implemented by the court. And I believe it is the Eighth Circuit that actually has the same kind of situation here, except that it involved witness for hire murder, and they clearly made findings that there was a need to protect the jury. But it was the same sort of disclosing of the party, of the jurors' names and addresses to the parties. Now, because...
Well, wait a minute. Which case are you talking about?
It's the U.S. v. Peoples, Eighth Circuit.
Not an organized crime case?
No, I think it's a capital case, and it is a murdering of a witness.
So what was not disclosed to the parties in that case?
I don't know that anything was not disclosed.
They got the jury information, where they lived, their names?
As far as I can tell from the record that's in the opinion, yes. They got the names and addresses.
Any other case?
I believe that both of them out of the Eighth Circuit might be the same. The other one is U.S. v. Lee. But that was decided more on whether or not security in the courtroom was appropriate.
Well, to trigger the standard, you're saying, basically that you're saying, here's what I take away from that, that the federal standard is triggered simply by the use of numbers directly in the juror's presence.
Yes.
Right? Not triggered by a failure to withhold some specific information.
Correct. It's triggered by any form of anonymity. And it runs the gamut, and I think that the Dinkins case does do a really good job of going through the history, going through what those various...
Case and Fourth Circuit case.
And it also talks about both capital and non-capital.
Can I follow up with that just 1 second? So with regard to this Eighth Circuit case that you say only applies to, I mean, it applies to a case in which the only thing that happened is the jurors were referred to by number. Do they find error and reverse?
They did not.
And so does it stand simply for the, I mean, so I'm not sure what the effect of that is. Is it just, you're just saying they analyzed it in terms of the two prongs, but said even in terms of those requirements, the judge was okay in this case?
Correct.
Okay.
It basically just stands for the proposition that we have this wide range of anonymous juries and what is or is not anonymous, all of which trigger this Part 1 and Part 2 test. And that is reflected in the state court decisions as well.
And I guess where I was going, that case or any of them, if you can recall, are there any that would actually find it to be error not to comply with the two-prong test where you only have a question of jurors referred to as numbers?
My presumption, and there aren't any cases that go over this point out of the federal law yet, but my presumption is that given the language used that they would, because each of them talks about how this is a drastic measure and you should only be using it where you have a actual and individualized need to protect the jury. Where you have an administrative rule for convenience, you don't have that piece of the test.
So just so I understand there too. So specifically with regard to the using numbers as distinguished from anything else, these cases, even though they don't find there to be error there, actually, you think the way they say the language indicates they're saying you would have to meet this two-prong test in order to use the numbers?
It indicates to me that they apply the same test for each type of anonymity, yes. Which brings me to a case that is very similar factually to Ms. Rizzo and Mr. Perez's case, as well as to the proposed administrative rule, local rule, however you want to term it, that Will County is trying to use. That is the Oregon case of Sundberg, where there was such a local rule that said we will be referring by two jurors by number. That is, as far as I'm aware, the only state Supreme Court that has substantively considered this local rule issue. And they didn't, they reversed. They paid particular attention to the risk, any risk being an unacceptable risk to the presumption of innocence, particularly in a case like Ms. Rizzo's, where credibility between the defendant and between the alleged victim is of such importance. Mr. Carberry touched on this also. The witnesses were the alleged victim and the defendant. That's it. Just like in Sundberg, it was a sexual assault case as well, and that's all the evidence that was available. So where you have credibility, you do not have overwhelming extrinsic evidence. You cannot impinge on what has been such a fundamental Sixth Amendment right. It follows defendants from the time they're charged all the way through trial. And expedience isn't enough.
Could I ask, just to make sure there, because I haven't had a chance to read that one either, other than just what you all said in your briefs, was it clear, do you think, that the Oregon court was relying exclusively on the Sixth Amendment, so it would stand for that proposition, that that's a violation of the Sixth Amendment?
They did. They relied, that wasn't the only thing they relied on, but they did implement the federal law that talks about it in detail. They said you cannot do this across the board. There has to be individualized reason to do so.
They relied on the Federal Circuit decisions?
Yeah,
is that?
That's correct.
And part of the reason I ask that is it's not uncommon, we know, for Oregon to sort of blend in things from its own constitution, but you feel like this was a United States constitutional
issue. They did make a good analysis of what the federal law was, and they did adopt it.
Okay, thank you.
Additionally, besides the federal courts running the gamut on what is or is not anonymous, state courts have also done the same. In fact, in and they have upheld or reversed, but they have uniformly applied the same test. Those include Brown out of Kansas, where the jury turned into an anonymous jury after voir dire was actually completed. That court also adopted the two-part test, and in addition, they, as in Tucker, the Wisconsin case, have a requirement that where you can meet prongs one and two, you have the danger and you take the precaution, you also have to give a specific instruction that neutralizes this about your anonymity and about using numbers and having no effect on the presumption of innocence or any implication about guilt or innocence.
Could you make a slightly different argument in your brief that I'd like to hear more about, which is you distinguish two types of error here. One is where we would review for abuse of discretion where safety of the juror is at issue, and the other is structural error for an administrative rule where there's no indication of juror safety.
Yes.
So could you talk about that?
I
believe the basis of that and why? And
that what Colorado should do is taken from what Anguillo did do, although it's not termed structural error, and also from what the dissent in the Ohio Supreme Court case in Hill stated, which was that because anonymous juries affect the entire conduct of the trial and the framework within which it occurs, if you impinge on that right, or if you take an action that could, it is structural error. And in line with that is...
Sorry, is that the Court of Appeals case? Or
that's the Court of Appeals case, which is then...
reversed.
...quoted by Justice Pfeiffer in his dissent. I believe that's the better approach. The Anguillo case is not strictly a structural error, but where you don't meet prong one, you don't have any reason, then it's reversed. So in effect, they treat it as if it were. And it, I think, kind of is highlighted by the Brookhaven decision, and it's in dicta, it's not the holding, but it's a discussion involving confrontation rights and constitutional protections for fundamental rights. And when a particular guarantee is violated, there isn't a substitute procedure that's going to cure it. You don't get to replace one fundamental right with another one and say, no harm, no foul. Not in that case. I think the same argument is made and should be made in cases like this, where you have something that would be changing the framework of how trials are done in the state of Colorado from basically forever to now, and do it simply because it's more convenient. I don't think that that's a rule or precedent that should be set, not for something like that.
Could I ask you to address what type of comments need to be made in this context to allay the concern? If in a numbers sense, the real concern is that the use of numbers instead of names, the argument is that it impinges on this presumption of innocence. Why, in your mind, does not the standard instruction about presumption of innocence, which is going to be given generally multiple times over the course of a trial, remind jurors and sort of erase any presumption in their minds that we might infer from the use of numbers?
There's actually a split in authority regarding that specific point. The Tucker, Wisconsin case and the Kansas cases require an additional statement, but there are some states that do not. I think that if you meet prong one, if you have an actual reason that's individualized to the case that you're trying, then while it would be nice to maybe to have a statement saying something like the use of numbers in no way implicates the defendant's innocence or guilt, it is strictly for media publicity or any reason like that would be okay. I don't think there's specifically been a court that has given one specific magic word that has to be used, just something to that effect that goes to the anonymity.
And that's over and above the standard burden of instruction on burden of proof and presumption of innocence.
In those jurisdictions, it is.
And I guess I'm curious about that because you're not, in fact, really addressing that presumption by such a comment. We're doing this to shield you from media scrutiny. It might justify the reason for the use of numbers, but it doesn't really address head-on that concern.
In addition, they still make the standard presumption of innocence instruction, and they also provide that instruction to neutralize the anonymity that's being used.
My understanding of your argument, maybe this is wrong, that you don't get into prong two at all. The only reason you have to get to prong two is if it's necessary because of the specifics of the case to use numbers, right?
That's
such as fear for the juror's safety.
Probably.
So in the average ordinary case, there is no numbers jurors.
That's correct.
So, actually, can I bounce off of that? How does media scrutiny figure into juror safety? We've got all these federal cases that use that as an excuse when, in fact, that might not, in fact, be the case. But let's assume there's not a true juror safety concern, but we are concerned about media scrutiny. How does that play into juror safety, or does it? Is it entirely separate?
I think there's one specific case that, if any case gets into media scrutiny and juror safety, it would apply to that case, and that's the U.S. v. Barnes case out of the Fifth Circuit, which was U.S. v. Branch Davidian trial. And in that case, there was worldwide publicity, and there were things being sent to prospective jurors, and they went anonymous for that reason. I can see that may have been a legitimate concern in that case. I think a lot of times courts use that reason, when it's not necessarily the reason, to appear to be more neutral. But as far as cases that actually analyze that prong in the factors, I think that one is a good one to look at.
But as tethered to prong one, meaning kind of an overarching concern about juror safety.
That was the prong one. And I guess it's just
we need to protect, there's this particular reason we need to protect juror privacy for me in a particular case, and if there's not a particular need, you don't meet prong one.
I think it would be an unusual case, which that would have been, where you have worldwide publicity or some other over and above the standard media attention where you may be being called or harassed. Maybe the Ross, Utah case can provide a good indication of when that might actually be a prong one reason. But most of the cases involve a variety of the five factors. So it is unusual for media attention to be the only factor.
So before you move on, I just want a clarification. I think comparing your argument to the arguments we've heard already, are you taking the position that you couldn't have a general policy of using or calling jurors by their number, or that such a policy might have been fine in this case, but instructions were insufficient or admonitions or explanations were insufficient?
I think that if we're going to change the criminal justice system and that to that degree, that we should do it for more of a reason than just expedience. So yes, I do take the position that I don't think that will meet constitutional muster if it's just for that reason.
But so there's a constitutional requirement that names be used, unless there's a sufficient explanation for them not being used, and it can't be policy.
I think probably the better way for me to try to explain that would be, not that there's a constitutional requirement for names to be used, because there's not, but if you're going to take some sort of action in the running of your trial that could negatively influence the presumption of innocence, then yes, you need more of a reason than just convenience of the court reporter.
Okay, so that, I mean, I guess the bottom line is Weld County, in your argument, can't have this policy.
That's correct.
Okay.
And could I just ask, because we keep talking about the first prong and some dangerousness to start with here, if that's always got to be present, then what there's nothing about it seems that everybody has agreed there's nothing about using only a number instead of a name that protects a juror from dangerousness at all, because all of the information is available in any event. So are you just basically, and I'm going back to our very first argument where I thought we were making a distinction between those cases that involved information getting out or being restricted as opposed to those that just use numbers, you're just basically saying there's no reason to make a distinction between those two situations at all. All have to be treated the same. Even if you're just using numbers, they have to be treated the same as if you were restricting information from the counsel.
I think the analysis needs to begin in the same manner, and you need to meet prong one. Once, and if you do that, if you do it for an actual reason, then you may have a difference in the rest and the prejudice prong, but you can't get there for expedience. You need a real reason. And if I may, I'd like to reserve my one.
Sure. Minute. Michaels? Justice Tobbs is anxious for...
Again, my name is Joseph Michaels, attorney registration number 40403. I'm here today still on behalf of the state of Colorado. Justice Hobbs, we concluded the previous argument with you asking what would be the remedy and what would you like us to see us do with the verdict. Is that about right?
Having to do with this
ruled.
How it was with this ruling.
Right, and whether language that we would put in our opinion might cause inadvertent consequences, such as the trail we went down with Curtis, where it became a litany, and if the litany wasn't followed precisely, the issue was, and defense counsel brought it up all the time, that should require reversal and a new trial.
Sure. We don't want a litany. We don't want an absolute failure to be a new trial for several reasons. And I'm going to answer that more clearly, I'm going to circle back to one of the very first statements I made in the very first argument, which is there has to be an objection. In the absence of an objection, there's no way to impose a prophylactic. There's no way to suggest that there was any prejudice to the defendant, and there's no way to suggest that the defendant was in fact bothered by that. And we have that in both of these cases today. Well, two of the three cases today, excuse me, in both in Robles and with Ms. Rizzo here today. The defense counsel didn't think anything of it. It didn't concern them. It didn't bother them. Especially with Ms. Rizzo, she had a significant advance notice that this was going to be the trial court's policy. So the very, very short answer to your question is, if there's no objection, then there just can't be any error because there's no chance to have issued a cautionary instruction. If there's an objection, or if there's an objection, then you give some sort of neutral explanation, as we discussed in the previous two. If that's not enough, at that point we review for harmless error to see whether in fact there was some prejudice. Did the jurors, were they heard out in the hall saying, "Boy, you know, we're being referred to by number. That means we're clearly the defendant is dangerous or something is fishy here." If we hear something like that, then that suggests there might be some prejudice. But there's nothing in the record that suggests that. And you also look at the amount of evidence that's introduced against the defendant. Is the prosecution's case strong? It becomes the routine harmless error analysis that this court, the Court of Appeals, always applies when we look at whether there's error or not. We're not looking at whether there's a litany of, well, was the defendant dangerous? Was there a great deal of media attention? We don't even need to get to that.
You can see it would be error not to give an explanation.
No.
So why would we review for harmless error? I'm a little confused by your argument.
Review for harmless. The reason we would give an explanation, and I do think it's a good idea to give an explanation. I do. But the idea is, if the defendant objects, then there's an opportunity for the trial court to make a record, to make that explanation, and to sort of settle down and right the ship, or at least put the appearance on record of saying, hey, there's not a problem with this. We want you to understand that. And that's why, in the absence of any objection, there just shouldn't be any review of it.
So in the absence of an objection, it's waived?
Yes.
Okay, and then under your harmless error review, what are we looking for?
What do you look for? Well, you look at quite a few things. The first thing that you would want to look for is the amount of evidence against the defendant. You would also want to see how effective the voir dire was. I talked in the Perez argument about the meaningfulness of the voir dire is the number one goal to get rid of any sort of prejudice and to make sure the defendant knows and has a that meaningful voir dire to get an unbiased jury. So we see it, we make sure the voir dire went according to plan. There's nothing irregular about it.
How does the meaningful voir dire part relate to the presumption of innocence and how that's burdened by the use of numbers? I certainly understand how meaningful voir dire is connected to the situation where defense counsel is not provided access to juror information. I see that connection, but I'm having trouble seeing how meaningful voir dire ties into presumption of innocence, unless during the course of that voir dire, counsel talk about that concept. So what are you looking for?
Well, that's part of it. You would be looking for a colloquy between a prosecutor or a defense counsel and a potential juror, and that potential juror says, oh, this really bothers me. Why are we doing this particular approach here? And that's a point where you say, okay, now we need an instruction. Now there might be some harm in here, but we don't presume that it's prejudicial. And there are numerous federal courts and numerous state courts say that we don't necessarily presume prejudice straight off the bat. Numerous courts are also saying that is the defendant's responsibility to show that prejudice, that the instruction had prejudiced him or her. The voir dire, the presumption of innocence, is further guarded, as I believe it was you said, that throughout the course of the trial, the jurors are repeatedly instructed about that presumption of innocence, about that burden of proof.
That's a really interesting point, because given that that instruction is going to be given in every single case, and if it's not, we have many other more important problems to worry about. But assuming that it is given in every single case, and it's your position that it in fact cures any concerns that we have about the absence of an explanation, it seems like it would never, ever be harmless error. It would always be harmless error. Pardon me.
Right. Backwards. Well, and that's why, first of all, you need an objection, and you need something that suggests otherwise. Because we don't presume that it's harmful. We don't presume that there's been an error. We presume that this is normal. The only difference is that they're referring to by name. And that's why the harmless error is so infrequent. And even in the state and federal courts, the harmless error is so, so infrequent in those cases. The cases that it occurs in, the Massachusetts case at Anguillo, it was reversed pursuant to a state rule, and second of all, the facts of that case were significantly different than those here. The names weren't, the jurors discovered mid-trial, there was no minimization of prejudice, there was no instruction from the trial court at all when the jurors found out, oh, why don't we have these names? And it was all based very directly on a state statute about the death penalty. So that case, to the extent that it applies, it just says essentially an explanation will be fine. The Sundberg case,
I just want to make sure that, once again, I'm reading your brief correctly now as opposed to the record. Because sure. In your brief, you say that the trial court did, in fact, call the jurors' names and numbers.
That's true.
Okay, yeah. So we have sort of three different things that happened among all these three cases. And in this one, the judge called the jurors' names, but then wanted them to be referred to by number?
That's absolutely right. The judge called their names in open court in front of Mr. Rizzo, in front of the parties, and then said, we're going to refer to you by number. And in fact, let me see if I can figure out exactly what was said, because the trial court here made a very clear statement that we're doing this as a routine policy for a cleaner record, and because it's convenient for our reporter. And it told the jury this, and it told them those are the reasons that we're referring to you by number, but it still called them by name so it associated with them. And
excuse me.
Sure.
And when he called the jurors to the box in the first place?
Yes.
He called them by name?
Yes.
And told them.
That's what I mean.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think I understood that in this particular case, this was a little bit different use of numbers. In other words, rather than the questionnaire that you arrive at the cattle call with 4067,
right,
that was not in fact the number that was used in this case. Rather, we pull 15 people into the box, called them by name, and then the numbers were assigned according to the seats they were sitting in. So juror number 4063 happens to be seated in seat number one.
Right.
Okay. I just want to make sure that I see that as a little bit different use of the numbers.
I honestly can't remember. I think that was the case, and that would be slightly different use. But again, that goes back to, this is how we're assigning seat numbers to jurors. We're associating them with a particular.
So did he say, for example, so Mr. Michael, your number is seat number three, so we're going to call you three from here on out?
Yes.
That's what he, so that person's name number was number three.
I believe that was the case. I would have to go back and
but really the records clearly had a name associated then with a seat, a chair.
Yes, or it certainly had a name associated with the number.
Well, so why is this even an anonymous or a number jury? I mean,
it's not.
On anyone's definition, I don't think that would fit an anonymous jury, right?
No, I agree. This is
it's very common for forget the numbers for a second, for a judge to call the people and then say you are seated in number four.
Right. That's absolutely correct. Putting them in specific.
Juror 406, you know.
Juror is your seat.
Your name, and then you're in. Go to number four.
No, I.
And then all he did is say we're now referring to you by number during the voir dire.
Right. And that's the twist of the other two is just instead of putting them in that seat number, that seat number is their juror number, and that's what they refer to.
But the bigger twist in the other two is that they never had that sort of transition between saying, Mr. Michaels, you're juror number 6,000 and you're in chair number four. and we're going to call you four from now on. There was that Mr. Michaels that was left out.
They didn't announce every single name in court, but they did explain how they were going to.
No, I understand, but I'm curious about, there was never a recitation of the name in open court in the earlier two cases.
Not going down the list of every name.
Okay, and in this case, there was.
Yes, that's correct. And something else about the Paris case, I think this occurred to me over the break, so sorry, well, you reminded me, but you had the problem about the prosecutor saying, I don't know your names.
Well, I didn't have a problem, so I was just reading from the transcript.
Sorry, you were reading from the transcript, but the prosecutor said, I don't know your names. I think he was referring to, I see your faces, but I don't have a name with a face yet. So that's what he was talking about, a disadvantage, because they all had his name and face. And that was simply, again, the colloquialism. What, sorry?
All had what?
With that panel of jurors in front of him, he had those names. He had all those faces, but he couldn't have identified them by name yet, because they hadn't started talking yet, so he didn't know.
Well, if that's the case, why would he go on to say something like, I think this is kind of rude, or, I mean, I could pull it up, I think, pretty quickly, what he said exactly.
Yeah.
And
I think he was just explaining the process.
Well, okay, but, I mean, I'm having more trouble than I wanted to. No, I've got it. Here we go. It seems to me kind of a rude thing to do, which is to refer to you by numbers. And you now have me at a disadvantage because I don't know any of your names. I'm going to address you by juror numbers, and it seems to me kind of a rude thing to do. So I'm going to call you by numbers. So hopefully you'll know your numbers.
Sure. And that's, again, because he doesn't know, he hasn't been able to associate a name with a face necessarily.
So you can just read the transcript. Thank you.
Sure, no problem. I do want to talk about the People's case very quickly that Ms. Harvey brought up. It's the Eighth Circuit case that she suggested applied the two-prong test, and it doesn't. It just simply said the district court has wide discretion to impanel an anonymous jury if it finds that a person's life, et cetera, et cetera. All parties were provided a list of the names and places of each member. We find the defendant's argument that the district court acted inappropriately to be without merit. It didn't apply any two-prong test when it had just the numbers. The other thing I wanted to address was the confrontation issue and the Bullcoming decision that both Mr. Carberry and Ms. Harvey brought up. And Bullcoming explicitly stated at the very end of the opinion that nothing in this opinion, and I'm quoting here, nothing in this opinion impedes a harmless error inquiry on remand. And it's nothing in Bullcoming or in our Confrontation Clause line of cases suggests that that is automatic structural error.
I ask you a question while you're still on structural error. I'm getting these cases mixed up, but so in Hill, which apparently was the one where we had a dissent, which would have joined or affirmed the Court of Appeals rationale about structural error, was that even though it's only a dissent, were they talking there about a purely numbers situation?
Hold on a second. I have a little cheat sheet that I have to admit I have to look at. I don't believe so. I believe that with Hill, it wasn't just about numbers. But the problem with Hill was that it partially wasn't preserved, so they didn't address the local policy issue, and they said that as a routine, it's not an issue of structural error. And that there was no plain error for it.
And I appreciate that with regard to the majority. And I'm just talking about several of your opponents at various times have wanted us to rely on the dissenting opinion there. But the language they used talked about anonymous juries being a structural error. And I just wondered if even the dissenting justice was looking at a situation, would have held structural error in a numbers only situation. Or could we tell that?
It wasn't clear. I mean, that wasn't very well. That wasn't addressed in the dissent, as far as I can recall. What I can tell you is that in all the numbers-only cases, and there aren't that many of them, they apply abuse of discretion. And that's Tucker deals with that. That's the Wisconsin case. Brown, which Ms. Harvey brought up, and that's the I think Kansas, and Samonte, which is the Hawaii case, all are talking about a local policy. And all of those, well, Samonte and Brown deal with actual withholding. No, Brown doesn't, sorry. Samonte deals with actual withholding of information, and Tucker and Brown deal with the numbers only application.
So Michaels, just to help you out here a little bit.
Sure.
There's actually a statute or local rule in Ohio that prohibits the giving of the names and the addresses to both grand juries and petit juries.
Right.
But the prosecution can request as needed, it says.
Right.
So that's what happened, and that wasn't objected to.
That wasn't objected to, and that's what the Ohio Supreme Court didn't want to look at. But then they looked at the policy later and said that structural error won't apply to it. Just a couple paragraphs later in that case, after they said we're not going to look at the rule. There's
a wealth of cases, and they're in my briefs. I don't want to throw sites at you for the rest of my 6 minutes. But anonymous juries describe situations where juror information is withheld. None of those cases here deals with that. None of them deals with anything besides referring to jurors by number, or here specifically identifying a juror as being a specific number.
You're not modifying your assessment of the federal case law at all based on what you've heard.
No, I'm going to stick with my, this is an anonymous jury, only if there's information withheld part of the argument. The two-prong test, you can look at it, and even if you wanted to apply it here, every case that you've heard about today would pass it for one reason or another, and I'm happy to talk about those if you want, but I know you've heard me talking for over an hour now. What I just want to say, I think in conclusion, this is a normal procedure. There's nothing inherently prejudicial about it, especially where the defendant has an effective voir dire, which we saw here. And there is, if we're concerned, an explanation, a neutral explanation is probably the way to go, but I would say it's prospective only. It's certainly none of the information in any of these cases requires reversal. And with that, I'm going to ask you to affirm all the convictions unless there are any questions from anybody.
Thank you, Mr. Mike.
Thank you. Thank you for your time.
Hello?
I guess in my minute, I would ask you all to reverse Ms. Rizzo's conviction. And when you formulate a law for Colorado moving forward, to do so with particular attention to those from Anguilla, Tucker, and the Hill dissent. All forms of anonymous jury, which you can see in Dinkins and in Peoples, where the life of the jury has to be endangered by preponderance of the evidence or nothing can be withheld. So I think they did apply that test. You use those for guidance. All forms throughout the gamut of anonymity are entitled to the same Sixth Amendment protection. You need an individualized, specific risk before you do any form of anonymity. Once you have that, then you can apply constitutional harmless error. And that's what I'm asking you to find today. Thank you.
I want to thank all the lawyers for their arguments, their briefs. The case will stand submitted on the briefs, and we will be in